content of this program is intended for people who are blind and can't compare it. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article is entitled, Mr. Rogers Had a Simple Set of Rules for Talking to Children. This is from June of 2018 and was written by Maxwell King. For the millions of adults who grew up watching him on public television, Fred Rogers represents the most important human values: respect, compassion, kindness, integrity, humility. On Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the show he created 50 years ago and starred in, he was the epitome of simple, natural ease. But as I write my forthcoming book, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers, Rogers' placidity belied the intense care he took in shaping each episode of his program. He insisted that every word, whether spoken by a person or a puppet, be scrutinized closely, because he knew that children, the preschool-age boys and girls who made up the core of his audience, tend to hear things literally. As Arthur Greenwald, a former producer of the show, put it to me, there were no accidents on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He took great pains not to mislead or confuse children, and his team of writers joked that his on-air manner of speaking amounted to a distinct language they called Freddish. Fundamentally, Freddish anticipated the way its listeners might interpret what was being said. For instance, Greenwald mentioned a scene in a hospital in which a nurse inflating a blood pressure cuff originally said, "I'm going to blow this up." Greenwald recalls, "Fred made us redub the line saying, 'I'm going to puff this up with some air,' because 'blow it up' might sound like there's an explosion, and he didn't want the kids to cover their ears and miss what would happen next." The show's final cuts reflected many similarly exacting interventions. Once Rogers provided new lyrics for the Tomorrow song that ended each show to ensure the children watching on Friday wouldn't expect a show on Saturday when the show didn't air. And Rogers' secretary, Elaine Lynch, remembered how, when one script referred to putting a pet to sleep, he excised it for fear the children would be worried about the idea of falling asleep themselves. Rogers was extraordinarily good at imagining where children's minds might go. For instance, in a scene in which an eye doctor uses an ophthalmoscope to peer into his eyes, he made a point of having the doctor clarify that he wasn't able to see Rogers' thoughts. Rogers also wrote a song called "You Can Never Go Down the Drain," because he knew that drains were something that, to kids, seemed to exist solely to suck things down. In 1977, about a decade into the show's run, Arthur Greenwald and another writer named Barry Head cracked open a bottle of scotch while on a break and coined the term Freddish. They later created an illustrated manual called Let's Talk About Freddish, a loving parody of the demanding process of getting all the words just right for Rogers. What Fred understood was very direct and articulate about was that the inner life of children was deadly serious to them, Greenwald said. Per the pamphlet, there were 9 steps for translating into Freddish. 1. State the idea you wish to express as clearly as possible and in terms preschoolers can understand. Example, it is dangerous to play in the street. 2. Rephrase in a positive manner, as in, it is good to play where it is safe. 3. Rephrase the idea, bearing in mind that preschoolers cannot yet make subtle distinctions and need to be redirected to authorities they trust, as in, ask your parents where it is safe to play. 4. Rephrase your idea to eliminate all elements that could be considered prescriptive, directive, or instructive. In the example, that would mean getting rid of ask. Your parents will tell you where it is safe to play. 5, rephrase any element that suggests certainty. That'd be will. Your parents can tell you where it is safe to play. 6, rephrase your idea to eliminate any element that may not apply to all children. Not all children know their parents, so your favorite grown-ups can tell you where it is safe to play. 7, add a simple motivational idea that gives preschoolers a reason to follow your advice. Perhaps your favorite grown-ups can tell you where it is safe to play. It is good to listen to them. 8, rephrase your new statement, repeating the first step. Good represents a value judgment, so your favorite grown-ups can tell you where it is safe to play. It is important to try to listen to them. 9, rephrase your idea a final time, relating it to some phase of development a preschooler can understand. Maybe your favorite grown-ups can tell you where it is safe to play. It is important to try to listen to them, and listening is an important part of growing. Rogers brought this level of care and attention not just to granular details and phrasings, but to the bigger messages his show would send. Hedda Sherapin, one of the staff members at Fred Rogers Production Company, Family Communications Incorporated, recalled Rogers once halted taping of a show when a cast member told the puppet, Henrietta Pussycat, not to cry. He interrupted shooting to make it clear that his show would never suggest to children that they not cry. In working on the show, Rogers interacted extensively with academic researchers. Daniel R. Anderson, a psychologist formerly at the University of Massachusetts, who worked as an advisor for the show, remembered a speaking trip to Germany during which some members of an academic audience raised questions about Rogers' direct approach on television. They were concerned that it would lead to false expectations from children of personal support from a televised figure. Anderson was impressed with the depth of Rogers' reaction and with the fact that he went back to production carefully screening scripts for any hint of language that could confuse children in that way. In fact, Freddish and Rogers' philosophy of child development is actually derived from some of the leading 20th century scholars of the subject. In the 1950s, Rogers, already well known for a previous children's TV program, was pursuing a graduate degree at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary when a teacher there recommended he also study under the child development expert Margaret McFarland at the University of Pittsburgh. There, he was exposed to the theories of legendary faculty, including McFarland, Benjamin Spock, Eric Erickson, and T. Barry Brazelton. Rogers learned the highest standards in this emerging academic field, and he applied them to his program for almost half a century. This is one of the reasons Rogers was so particular about the writing on his show. I spent hours talking with Fred and taking notes, Greenwald said, and then hours talking with Margaret McFarland before I went off and wrote the scripts. Then Fred made them better. As simple as Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood looked and sounded, every detail in it was the product of a tremendously careful, academically informed process. This article is adapted from Maxwell King's forthcoming book, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. Next, How My Wife and I Took Back Our Sundays by Jason Heller. This is from February 2023. A few weeks ago, my wife Angie and I made a pact. Every Sunday, we swore to each other, we will abstain from work. And we kept our promise. On the second day of each weekend, we start our morning and end our night by binging TV in bed. In the middle of the day, we binge TV on the couch, taking breaks exclusively to nap or read. The door of our apartment is opened only for pizza to be slid inside. Chores go undone. Fitness is spurned. Job-related emails or, God forbid, texts are not read. When we feel the familiar anxiety creeping in and imagine our inboxes filling or our muscles turning to jelly, we're tempted to act, but we fight to stay still. Lazy Sunday, as Angie and I like to call it, is hardly a revolutionary idea. A weekly time of rest is, after all, an ancient staple of several religions. And the five-day work week has been the standard in the U.S. since the Great Depression. Spillover into non-work days, though, is common. A 2015 RAND survey, for instance, found that about half of American employees do work in their free time in order to meet job demands. For many who started working from home during the pandemic, the boundary between labor and leisure has dissolved even further. More and more individuals can't rely on societal norms or even their own employers to draw that line for them. They have to do it themselves. Angie and I shouldn't need to actively protect our one day off to make it a ritual, but sadly, we do. Even without explicit orders to work through the week, rest time can feel indulgent or unnatural. I grew up poor, like government cheese and constant eviction poor. My single mom and grandma both waited tables. My grandpa and uncle both drove trucks. They were always ready to work at the drop of a hat, especially during a busy weekend shift or for time and a half. Earlier in the pandemic, I worked long overtime hours at a warehouse, pulling orders of organic dog food from a giant industrial freezer. Now I'm lucky enough to have an office job, but I use Saturdays for freelance writing. The instinct to hustle, whether for success or just survival, is hard to shake. Still, we do need respite, not only from our jobs, but from all of the many obligations that crop up in adult life. Angie, who works remotely in IT, is essentially always on call during the week. She's also a caregiver for her mom, who has multiple sclerosis, and her brother, who has paranoid schizophrenia. Every Saturday, she helps them with cleaning, shopping, and health care. That time is deeply meaningful, and she's happy to spend it with them, but it's also draining. This is part of why rest is crucial. We need to show up for other people, and in order to do that well, we need time to recover in between. Of course, taking a consistent day off is an immense privilege. And yet, even when you can take it, there are plenty of ways to avoid actually doing so. Pre-packed, Angie and I often use Sundays to prep for the coming work week. We thought we were buying time that we could spend later. The problem is that work is a bottomless pit. There's always more to do. The harder we try to get ahead, the stronger the gravity becomes. Or perhaps you've just internalized the itch to keep moving and doing. You might think absolute inactivity, even for just one day a week, sounds more boring than desirable. Angie and I, however, don't just do nothing. We let nothing become something. On one lazy Sunday, we Googled a familiar actor in the show we were watching and wound up going down an internet movie database rabbit hole. Hours later, we were still in bed, excitedly looking up obscure character actors from our youth, which led us to share memories and ask questions we might otherwise not have, at least not with as much mutual presence and attention. Sometimes the people we've been close to for decades are the very people we tend to take for granted, the ones we stop getting to know. Taking a break gives Angie and me the opportunity to really see each other again. That might be the most important reason to pause work, not just to fuel up in preparation for more work later on, but for the sake of the pause itself. Although Angie and I aren't religious, we really do think of our secular day of rest as sacred. That's why we take pains to protect it, even when it means turning down some career opportunities or the next week being a little more stressful. When you take away all the tasks you might feel pressed to do on a Sunday, what you're left with isn't an absence, it's an opening. Next, a counterintuitive way to cheer up when you're down. When you most need to get happier, Try Giving Happiness Away by Arthur C. Brooks. Norman Rockwell painted some of the most iconic images of 20th century America. His paintings, such as Rosie the Riveter and the Four Freedoms series from World War II, and The Problem We All Live With, and Murder in Mississippi from the Civil Rights Movement, were intended to evoke the best in people who saw them. Hope, solidarity, courage, justice, but most of all, happiness. The bulk of his work captured scenes of lighthearted joy. Consider Shiner, which depicts a young girl with a black eye, sitting outside the principal's office with a grin that tells you she has just been the victor in combat. I have seen these paintings my whole adult life, starting with my grandfather's beloved dog-eared coffee table book of Rockwell's greatest works. A printing press operator in Longview, Washington, my grandfather was no art connoisseur, but he gave this assessment of Rockwell: "These pictures make me feel happy." And yet, Rockwell himself struggled with happiness. In 1953, he moved to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, a bucolic town in the Berkshires, not for its natural beauty and peace, but because it happened to be the home of a psychiatric hospital where he and his wife could receive treatment for chronic depression. There, he was a patient of the world-famous psychoanalyst Erik Erikson, with whom Rockwell racked up a therapy bill so large that he had to accept commissions for Kellogg's Corn Flakes magazine ads. That a man with such significant happiness problems would be known for painting images of undeniable happiness might seem ironic. In truth, it's not strange at all. Research shows not only that you can bring joy to others even if you're unhappy, but also that doing so is a reliable way to improve your own well-being, too. That doesn't come naturally to most of us, however, to our detriment. To make a change, we can start by understanding how the process works, so we can build better habits and consciously commit to giving happiness when we most need to get it. Few of us want our negative moods to drag others down, but in practice, a lot of people follow a theory of happiness that can be summed up in the famous line from airline safety videos: put on your own mask before assisting others. In other words, you can't make others happy unless and until you are happy yourself. I get the reasoning. Unhappy people often bring wretchedness to those around them. Think of the most miserable boss you've had, and you'll know what I mean. This belief is backed up by research. As Lane Wallace wrote in The Atlantic in 2011, longitudinal studies of families show that one person's unhappiness can be poison to others in close proximity. Wallace noted that women married to unhappy men tend to be unhealthier and live shorter lives than those married to happy men. Children whose mothers have a happy marriage are 18 percentage points more likely to be happy at home than those with mothers in an unhappy marriage. Misery loves company, according to the old adage, and untreated, it creates company, too. None of us wants to be the purveyor of poison, especially towards those we love. Fortunately, research also shows that we have more control over how we affect others and ourselves than we might assume. The key is to act like a happy person would, even if you don't feel like it. Last year, researchers at the University of California at Riverside asked human subjects to behave in either extroverted or introverted ways for 1 week. They found that those purposefully acting extroverted, with which decades of research have shown is one of the most common characteristics of happy people, saw a significant increase in well-being. Meanwhile, acting introverted led to a decrease. Similarly, spending money on others and volunteering have both been shown to raise one's own happiness level. One plausible explanation for why this works is that prosocial behaviors induce a cognitive dissonance. I feel unhappy, but I am acting happy, which people resolve subconsciously by feeling happier. Richard Wiseman, a psychologist at the University of Hertfordshire in the United Kingdom, calls this the as-if principle. If you want to feel a certain way, act as if you already do, and your brain will grant you that feeling, at least for a while. In common parlance, fake it till you make it. I am not suggesting here that fake it till you make it is a substitute for traditional medical treatment for depression, of course. Norman Rockwell, for instance, was in formal therapy most of his adult life, but his happy paintings were clearly part of his treatment. As Rockwell's biographer Deborah Solomon points out, he was painting his longing. So paint your longing. Even if not literally, you can use the Rockwell formula in your own life to bring more joy to yourself and the people around you when you are down. First, ask what happy people in your life situation would do to make things better for themselves and others. How would they greet others in the first Zoom call of the day? How would they write an email? Whom would they just call to just check in? If you're stuck, interview happy people you know about the little things they do for their acquaintances and loved ones. Next, make a plan to follow through on everything you just imagined and commit to it. Write 3 ideas for extra kind greetings on a post-it note and stick it below your computer screen before that Zoom call. Draft a sample email in the voice of a happy person and use it as a template. Make a list of friends and family with whom you're overdue for a chat, and schedule those calls in your planner. These steps aren't a set of direct happiness adjustments. They're more of a bank shot. By deliberately preparing yourself to cheer up the people around you the way a happy person spontaneously would, you'll create the conditions by which you can produce your own happiness naturally, and give the gift of happiness to others as well. Now, here's an ode to nicknames by James Parker. Here's what I think about Spare by Prince Harry. I think it's a very interesting book, a feat of psychosensory downloading by the master ghostwriter J.R. Moringer. But it should have been called Spike. The Spare, as in not the heir, is what members of the royal family have allegedly dubbed the brooding prince. Spike, however, is his nickname, or his most resonant one. It's the one used by his more roistering and familiar chums. Spike is who Harry really is. Spike is his punk rock, Etonian ginger essence. Spike, as T.S. Eliot put it in The Naming of Cats, is his ineffable, deep and inscrutable singular name. Your parents named you, of course, but bless them, they had no clue who you were. They plucked your name out of the air for their own reasons, their own sentimentalities, like they were getting a tattoo. And a newborn baby has no relationship with its name. Next to the exploding, barbaric baby self, its name, so thoughtfully chosen, so fondly given, is a nothing. Your friends, however, and your enemies, they know who you are. They'll give you your real name, behind your back sometimes, which almost guarantees its accuracy. They're reporting on angles and aspects of you that you can't even see. No one comes up with their own nickname. A boxer or a wrestler might name himself, glorify himself with some sobriquet, but that's different. That's branding. Marvelous Marvin Hagler is not a nickname. There are no bad nicknames or wrong nicknames for the simple reason that if they're bad or wrong, they don't stick. If it sticks, like it or not, it's your nickname. At school, I was Gobit because I was small or goblin-like or in some way like a discrete chunk of matter. Whatever, it stuck. My son was 10 when he first called me Mr. Personal Pants for my habit of taking everything personally. Reeling with self-recognition, I protested in vain that writers have to take everything personally. It's our job. There are ironic nicknames, counter nicknames. The Viking-sized rugby player known to his teammates as Tinkerbell. But maybe there is something darting and sprightly about him. Insane-seeming nicknames, deriving perhaps from some now-forgotten incident. Another kid at school was called Bleh Bleh, not Blah Blah, Bleh Bleh. Having trouble remembering someone's nickname? Someone's name? Give them a nickname. Sci-Fi Mike, Second Wave Dave, Eugene the Unitarian. As long as some fiber of their primary nature adheres to it, you won't forget it. Meanwhile, other people will be doing this to you, fixing you, capturing you, naming you. So don't waste a lifetime wondering who you are. Listen for your nickname. We are nearly out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a wonderful day.